WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. A conservation group warns about the effects of data centers on natural resources. Hundreds of residents get free medical care at the latest RAM pop-up clinic in Fishersville. And at Shenandoah University, the Virginia Forum celebrates 20 years of gathering historians. This is the WMRA Daily for Wednesday, March 25th. As Virginia's data center industry booms, its demands for land, water, and electricity continue to grow. The National Parks Conservation Association has published a report about how this development threatens the Mid-Atlantic region's natural resources. WMRA's Randy B. Hagee reports.
Immense amounts of electricity, electrical grid infrastructure, and water from the Potomac River will be needed to sustain Virginia's data center growth in the coming years, according to energy executives and watershed scientists. The footprints of proposed data centers could physically encroach upon the Prince William Forest Park and Manassas National Battlefield.
But, you know, it doesn't just stop at the data centers themselves. You also got to think about how are these data centers getting powered.
Ben Alexandro is a conservation strategist and the primary author of the NPCA report. The Richmond Times-Dispatch reported in February that data centers have requested hookups for nearly 70 gigawatts of power from Dominion Energy. Dominion's last annual report states the company owns about 31 gigawatts of generating capacity. They expect to more than double their generation capacity in the next 20 years, with much of their growth being driven by the booming data center industry. Then there's the water that many data centers use to cool their servers. The Interstate Commission on the Potomac River Basin reports that data centers currently draw, on average, 14 million gallons of water from the river on the hottest peak usage days. With unchecked growth, that could balloon to around 170 million gallons. Compare that to the water that flows out of the Shenandoah National Park and eventually joins the Potomac, which Alexandro estimates at around
212 million gallons of clean water per day.
The NPCA's recommendations include data center regulations that would require transparency around water and energy use, and increased oversight that accounts for cumulative regional impacts. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
5 years after a Confederate statue in Charlottesville was removed, the materials used to make that monument will be repurposed to create a new public art installation. Hannah Davis Reed with VPM News has more.
In 2021, the Swords into Plowshares project was launched. The project invites artists to create a new public art installation from the melted bronze of the statue of Robert E. Lee that was formerly housed in Market Street Park. Swords into Plowshares co-founder Jillian Schmidt said that the idea is an act of care for the community and future generations.
We will figure out a way so that our, what we call toxic waste, is not simply sent down the road to another community where it continued to do damage, but rather transformed into something useful, healthy, life-giving.
Designers applied with their visions, and now it's down to three finalists. Each intends to turn, quote, historical trauma into an artistic expression of democratic values and inclusive aspirations. Design firms presented their proposals at the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center earlier this month. Now the public has until May 30th to vote at either a ballot box at the center or online. The winning design will be announced on July 10th.
Hannah Davis Reed reporting. Hundreds of people got free medical care in Fishersville over the weekend when the national nonprofit Remote Area Medical set up a pop-up clinic at the Augusta Expo Event Center. Randy paid a visit and filed this report.
Augusta Expo was thronging with organized action on Saturday, with a line of patients entering the main event center that, at other times, hosts antique sales, wedding receptions, and sporting events. Remote Area Medical, or RAM, had transformed the space into separate bays for triage, general medical, vision, and dental care. The main room was nearly full of clear plastic tents, each hooked up to a ventilation system.
This is our dental floor. We've got 40 dental operatories set up, and so our kind of standard size is about 20. So this is about double what we normally do. So we are absolutely rocking and rolling today.
Lindsay Allison is a clinic coordinator with RAM. This is the third time the nonprofit has held a clinic in Fishersville in collaboration with a RAM chapter at UVA.
So we've got general medical services along with women's health services. They're doing some physical therapy. The host group here has worked really hard brought in a ton of community resources, including a clothing closet, a food bank. We've got a chiropractor. We're doing haircuts back there. They've gotten a lot of books in English and Spanish for children and games and toys to play with while they're waiting. We've also got our mobile denture unit here today, so they are actually printing dentures on site.
These clinics rely on volunteer labor, both from medical providers from across the region and support staff, including college students. Tara Verma is a sophomore studying pre-med at the University of Maryland College Park.
We're on buckets for dental disinfection.
She's from Maryland, between D.C. and Baltimore, but is interested in rural health care. This was her first RAM clinic, and she was on her phone signing up for more when I caught her during a break.
So we go into each room and we sterilize the suctions, we get rid of all the blood, we dispose of the trash bags, we change out the sheets on the beds the patients lay on.
It seems like kind of a rough job.
You can't be squeamish. There's still a lot of blood and like spit.
This was RAM's first clinic back in Fishersville since Augusta Health closed three clinics in Rockbridge and Augusta counties in response to Medicaid cuts, other changes in federal funding, staffing issues, and decreasing populations. The hospital's community health needs assessment, published in May of last year, said that finding a doctor, getting an appointment, and the costs of visits and prescriptions were barriers for about half of survey respondents. Over a quarter did not have a primary care physician or other source of ongoing medical care. The RAM clinic served more than 585 people this weekend. All services were provided completely free on a first-come, first-served basis. No insurance or even ID required. Amanda Andrews drove up from Natural Bridge in Rockbridge County.
Oh gosh, honey, I got here at 5:30.
She said there were already three rows of cars lined up across the giant gravel lot by then. Andrews came for vision services. It had been 10 years since she got a new pair of glasses, but on Saturday, she walked out with a pair of maroon frames fitted with her new prescription.
Well, I don't have insurance right now, so this right here is the best. And, you know, even some insurances don't pay for, you know, very good glasses or nothing like that. You know, I appreciate everything that they do. You know, people get medical care, they get their dental care and vision care, and ain't got to pay nothing. These days and time, you know, it's hard to get that stuff.
Dr. Megan Moore, an optometrist from Roanoke who practices in Lynchburg, noted that these services can be cost prohibitive for people with insurance, too. At midday, Moore was stationed at a computer reviewing images of the cells inside patients' eyes.
We were doing fundus images, which are pictures of the inside of the back of the eye, explaining to a lady about how her diabetes is affecting her eyes.
In addition to providing care and making eyeglasses, they also refer patients to specialists in the region as needed.
I mean, I had a lady earlier that had an elevation, and so we're going to refer her to an ophthalmologist. So she has a little, kind of like a retinal cyst, so we don't exactly know what the causative thing is for it. So she needs to see a specialized ophthalmologist.
Moore was accompanied by her daughter and daughter's boyfriend, who also volunteered in the vision ward.
We just, you know, we like giving back to the community. We've been to different areas, so this is the first time we've been in Fishersville. We were in Lexington a few months back, been to Grundy a couple of times. You know, remote medicine is definitely, like, these are communities that just do not have great access, period.
The next clinic in our area will be held at Luray High School in September. More information about their services and how to pitch in are available at ramusa.org. For WMRA News, I'm Randy Behage.
You can see photos from the clinic at WMRA.org and on our app. The University of Virginia women's basketball team is headed to the Sweet 16 in this year's NCAA tournament. They are the first team to ever reach the Sweet 16 in college women's basketball history that was on the bubble to qualify to participate. The number 10 seed defeated the number 2 seeded Iowa 83-75 in a double overtime game on Monday in Sacramento. Dominion Energy's major coastal Virginia offshore wind project is now sending surges of power to the grid. The Virginia Mercury reports the system's first commercial turbine was switched on Monday. It is the largest offshore wind project in America. The single turbine, separate from the structure's two pilot turbines that have been operational since 2020, is producing 14.7 megawatts, transmitting electricity via underwater cables. Dominion said it's a major milestone for the project, which faced a federal stop work order due to reported national security concerns in December. The project is about 70% completed, with 176 monopiles built and 157 transition pieces installed. It's located off the coast of Virginia Beach, and power flows to a transmission station at the nearby state military reservation. The mother of a woman allegedly murdered by an undocumented man in Northern Virginia was in Richmond Tuesday. Advocates who flanked her pushed for cooperation agreements between local police and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. But some of Virginia's most conservative localities recently said no to that. Radio IQ's Brad Kuttner reports.
I think that everyone should be advocating for a federal cooperation agreement with ICE.
That's Nicole Kiperloff with the American Border Story, a group, quote, dedicated to exposing the human impact of America's border crisis near the steps of the Capitol Tuesday. She stood alongside Cheryl Minter, the mother of Stephanie Minter, a Fairfax County woman who was killed earlier this year, allegedly by an undocumented person. Here's Cheryl, who spoke briefly at the event.
I had her for 41 years. And I don't know what I'm going to do without her.
Cheryl Minter didn't mention politics, but Kiperloff stressed the importance of cooperation agreements with federal agencies.
Immigration is a federal, state, and local issue. Absolutely 100%. And it goes all the way down to the community level.
But only 2 weeks earlier, at a Lynchburg City Council meeting, Nathan Hendricks with the Blue Ridge Police Benevolent Association asked the Republican-leading locality to vote no on an effort that would force such an agreement.
Federal immigration enforcement and local law enforcement have two very different missions. Respecting these differences is not opposition to immigration enforcement. It is recognition of the fact that different agencies exist for different purposes.
Hendricks also defended Lynchburg Police Chief Ken Edwards' request for a no vote.
And our board does not believe that his decision in this case will negatively impact public safety.
Lynchburg City Council members voted down the effort to enter the 287G agreement 4-2. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Virginia lawmakers approved legislation to give public schools state guidance on artificial intelligence. Dean Mirshahi with VPM News has more.
The bill would require Virginia's Department of Education to come up with statewide guidance for K-12 public schools on AI systems. VDOE's guidance would cover several key areas that lawmakers targeted, including student data privacy, training for teachers, and protections against AI bias. State Senator Stella Pekarsky, a Fairfax Democrat, says her bill helps address concerns over AI use in education.
AI is here. AI is in our classrooms. We need to have some statewide guidance that is developmentally and instructionally appropriate for our schools to follow as they create their policies.
The legislation is on Governor Abigail Spanberger's desk, where she has until April 13th to sign, amend, or veto the measure.
Dean Mirshahi reporting. The Virginia Forum was held at Shenandoah University on its 20th anniversary last weekend, bringing people together from different fields of study, such as Virginia history and literature. WMRA's Aisha Piergum reports.
Warren Hofstra is on the history faculty at Shenandoah University and one of the founders of the Virginia Forum. He says that 20 years ago, there was a real shortcoming that led to his collaboration with another colleague to call for a conference.
There did not exist in the state of Virginia an annual meeting or an organization for people who work on the history and geography and literature on various aspects of Virginia culture.
They sent out a call for papers in 2005.
Thinking that we might get 20 or 30 responses. We got close to 80. And then we thought maybe 30 or 40 people would come to this small event we were planning, and 250 people came. 20 years, meeting all over the Commonwealth of Virginia, different universities, museums, and historical societies.
He says that even though a large percentage of people who come to the forum work in fields related to history, the institution is going to be more eclectic.
Virginia has such a rich and complex and even troubled history, so there's so much to write about. So a large percentage of people who come to the forum work in the field of history and history scholarship and history teaching. But I think, you know, one of the ways it's changed is to be always open to many different disciplines, different points of view.
Jonathan Noyales is the Hugh and Virginia McCormick Chair in Civil War History at Shenandoah University. He is also the chair of this year's Virginia Forum. Nayala says the conference is where a lot of historians share their new research and insights.
And it really covers the gamut of Virginia history from, you know, Jamestown settlement, colonial Virginia history, all the way through revolution, you know, Civil War, and of course, even into more modern times.
This year's main theme is
revolutions and resistance. There are a number of panels that focus on the American Revolution, but it's really about change and resisting oppression throughout the course of Virginia history.
Nayala says they had a broad area of papers.
To me, one of the most interesting, I'm a Civil War historian by training, and so there was a session earlier this morning about the different ways that women in this part of Virginia tried to navigate the complexities of war and how they cared for their families and dealt with all the uncertainties of the conflict. So for me, that's the highlight.
Devon Ava is an associate professor of history at Sweetbriar College and was also one of the organizers of last year's Virginia Forum. She studies Prince Edward County.
And I'm really interested in the story of school desegregation there, how the community dealt with, responded to, rebounded from massive resistance.
Vo says her work examines the period after schools reopened in 1964 to the early 2000s.
And I am interested in the policies that developed within the school and how that demonstrated beliefs about education, thoughts about race and within the community. But I'm also interested in the memory aspect of desegregation and how those policies reflect that memory.
Evie Toronto is a professor of art history at Randolph-Macon College. Her focus is another example of the rich vein of history that runs through the Commonwealth and infuses our politics in the present day.
I have been working on Confederate monuments in particular, the politics of Confederate monuments for about 20 years.
Toronto says that while she was researching her dissertation topic on sanitary affairs of the Civil War,
I realized how much of the Confederate landscape is intact, so I began to research Confederate monuments.
Toronto says she had initially published on Confederate monuments in Baltimore because there was no scholarship at the time and very little was known about the monuments. When living in Richmond, she says she became familiar with the politics of the Confederate landscape.
And my perspective was always that these were invisible, right? People were aware of them, but they didn't necessarily engage with the rhetoric or the politics of the monuments until obviously the aftermath of Charlottesville and the violence that occurred there. So I began to look more broadly at the contemporary context.
The Virginia Forum concluded on Saturday, March 21st, after more than a total of 30 sessions and a celebration of its 20th anniversary. For WMI News, I'm Aisha Pirge.
We've posted a longer version of this story and links to more information at WMRA.org and on our app. Finally today, researchers at the University of Virginia say they have developed an algorithm to help people with type 2 diabetes better manage their condition. The researchers say that the innovation from the UVA Center for Diabetes Technology, paired with a continuous glucose monitor, can recommend insulin dose adjustments. The algorithm helps streamline the process of adjusting the self-monitoring of blood sugar levels. The research is published in the scientific journal Diabetes Technology and Therapeutics. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy your Wednesday.